So Dee was talking about a little book. It's called 100 Questions and Answers About MDS, Everything You've Always Wanted to Know. Some physician offices carry it. Some carry it in their resource center. Anyway, the MDS Foundation, there is a second edition being written, and I'm not quite sure when the publication date of that is, but it's coming out. So, all right. This time has been reserved for question and answers. Probably lots more questions than there are answers, and that's perfectly fine. But just kind of wondering who's got the most burning question? Oh, the other thing is, my IT helpers are bringing in those sandwiches and stuff, and it's going to be on the back. So when you do leave, please grab stuff to take home, okay? Because it's out there. Questions. One thing, let's talk about this. I'm going to borrow your book for a minute. Dr. Shimano made a reference to doing the IPSS score, okay? I'll see if I can find it in this book. Understanding MDS, I think. Cytogenetic testing classified, page 13. Yes. Oh, one more question. These two gentlemen who are here actually are from a company called Celgene, and Celgene is the pharmaceutical company who provides lenalidomide as well as thalamid, thalidomide, and a bunch of other drugs. But Sam is a reimbursement specialist. So if you are on an oral therapy or even an injectable therapy, 5-azacitidine, you guys still hold the patent on that? I don't know. He's the reimbursement specialist. So if you have questions about reimbursement, for those of you who aren't on therapy, lenalidomide is an oral agent. Depending on your prescription package and provider, it is how you're going to obtain the drug. It's a specialty drug. It's considered an oral chemotherapy drug. Sometimes it gets shipped from specialty pharmacies, or it gets special ordered from Walgreens, CVS, wherever you're picking up your medicines. But copays, now you can tell me, I'm not trying to like embarrass you, but the cost of the drug is per month?
For this drug?
Right?
The drug could be pretty costly, so.
Like $5,000 a month?
10 grand.
10 grand, okay. I guess I didn't get the update. So nobody affords that. Maybe Prince Charles, but he doesn't need it. So reimbursement specialists are on staff with all the pharmaceutical companies to help us navigate the financial burden of healthcare. And so that's Sam's job to help do that. So if there's anybody here who has questions, comments, problems, he's your man. If you want to just raise your hand, he can give you his card, and then you have his number. Feel free to raise your hand. But if not, Sam's going to go because he would really like to go outside and play. And if we don't need him, he's out of here. Good enough?
He has to meet his future in-laws.
Okay, yeah, he's meeting his future in-laws.
Maybe we do know that, don't we?
Yes, we do. We rode up in the elevator.
They rode up in the elevator. That's funny. Okay, IPSS scores. I should know this like the back of my hand. Okay, so the IPSS score is done when you get diagnosed, okay? You don't rescore yourself. That's not how it's done. So when you initially are diagnosed with your MDS, there are three components. There is the number of cytopenias. So we look at cytopenias at white cells, red cells, and platelets. So for white cells, it's if your absolute neutrophil count is under 1,000, hemoglobin under 10. This is the standard that it was done with. And then, and platelets under 100,000. So those are cytopenias. If you have none of those, it gives you that component. So there's three components: blood counts, cytogenetics, and number of blasts. Okay? So, and then cytogenetics. Remember, there was a very complicated slide that showed all the different possible cytogenetics. Some are good, that score 0. Some are intermediate, that give you a score of 0.5. And some, if you have 3 or more, it's considered high risk, and that gives you a higher score.
Blasts are 100,000?
No, that can't be.
No. Okay.
Platelets, 100,000 per platelets. Yes, sir.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Is there a cure
For
my particular case.
Do you mind telling everybody what your particular case is so we can kind of speak apples to apples?
Yes, with 5Q minus.
So 5Q minus only.
Yes.
Yes. So just to make that clear. Can I give a little snip? Hang on. So 5Q, when you have MDS and your only cytogenetic abnormality is 5Q minus, that means the fifth chromosome. Chromosomes are very interesting. They have arms. They have P arms on the top and they have Q arms on the bottom. So when someone says they have 5Q minus, to me that says it's your only cytogenetic abnormality and your only problem is that on the fifth chromosome, the Q arm is either totally gone or there's an interstitial deletion or there's a component missing. And that's what Mr. Hensel has, correct?
Right.
5Q minus. And we know that lenalidomide has terrific success for people who have 5Q minus.
So,
okay.
I've come on for years with the same blood analysis.
You mean CBC counts?
Yes.
So now your blood counts are stable.
It's worked up to, I'm about normal.
When was the last time you had a transfusion?
Pardon me?
When was the last time transfused?
Before he started.
Forever ago.
Forever, 11 years.
11 years. Okay. So.
With that hasn't changed in years, all of my various counts. And they're all normal. And am I cured?
Are you cured? Here's a question I have for you. Dr. Lark.
We don't know.
We don't know. And that's, I'm going to like sneak down that little cubbyhole also and say I don't know, but it's an excellent question. When you have a bone marrow done, do you still have the 5Q minus deletion? Is it there or no?
You know, I don't know.
Okay, you don't know either. So it's interesting because, you know, these sophisticated smart drugs that are finding usage in very unique situations, you know, your stem cell, here's how I conceptualize it. Your stem cell is probably still abnormal, and the drug continues to keep it in remission and keep your blood counts normal. What would happen if we stopped your Revlimid? I don't know. There really are two possible answers. You could be cured, and your blood counts would remain normal. The other answer is you would relapse. How long would that take? Good question. Well, maybe not so long, or maybe a long time. And if you relapsed, would you respond again? And a lot of these questions are unique with some of the other drugs that we have out there that specifically are for a very small individual group of patients, like CML patients take a drug called imatinib. The same question is being asked, am I on this drug forever? Now I'm normal, am I cured? Can we stop therapy?
Well, I guess we're all looking for it. We're taking this medication, now we've stabilized. It's like an aspirin taking care of your headache.
Exactly.
And when your headache is gone, you can stop taking aspirin.
Is that true? Right. I don't, you know, the current thinking in hematology is that if you're on the medicine and it's corrected your blood counts, you need to continue to take it because if it's not then causing your blood counts to go in the other direction, it's working physiologically, and so it continues to keep you in remission. Like a diabetic with their insulin. Their blood sugars are high, they take the insulin, I'm not a diabetic anymore, what happens if I don't? So it's that analogy, and there's really not a good answer because...
I have a question too. Rich was, you know, he was, as I say, it's over 5 years now. But
are these microphones hot? No?
They need to be turned and closed.
So we can't use them so we can hear one another? Okay, that's good. We'll try to use the microphones.
Okay.
All right, Sylvia, start again.
He was...
Hang on.
I would say about a year ago.
Don't be shy.
The doctor had said, let's try and take the Vidaza maybe 5 weeks and 6 weeks. He did that for about 2 or 3 infusions, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden it started.
Blood counts.
And right away he said, you don't want to lose it because you may, if you relapse, you may never get back to where
right,
you were.
Exactly.
So he's back to 4 every 4 weeks. And things have little by little stabilize. He's still not up where he was a year or so ago, but at least he's at that point where it's better. So
right, it's very individual and hard to say.
Very much so.
You know, I'm not sure how many cycles you had. So I don't know if you've heard.
He said 60 cycles.
60.
60.
As in 5 years worth.
Correct.
Okay.
Are these what they're talking about? Is this the low impact?
So do you know, Rich? Do you know were you an intermediate or?
Intermediate.
So let's go back to the CIPSS scoring. Okay. So I'm going to pretend that. We'll give a scenario. How do you score it? And I'm sorry I don't have this computer behind me, but that's okay. So the score goes from 0 and then 0.1, 1, 1.5, or 2 or greater. Okay? So 0 if in the IPSS, this is not the revised, 0 is low risk. Okay? 0.5 to 1 is low risk. 1 to 1.5 is intermediate risk. And then when you... high risk is 2.5 and above. So each of those three components had a score, correct? So if I go into the doctor and I'm getting diagnosed with MDS and they do all my workup, so they draw my blood and I have normal platelets, I have a normal white count, but my hemoglobin is 7, okay? So I only have one cytopenia. So that gives me a 0 score in the blood count part. And they do my bone marrow biopsy, and I have a very nice nurse practitioner who does it, and she does a great job. So, but they draw back my DNA, and they get it back, and they say, you have a 5Q minus as your only cytogenetic abnormality. I know that 5Q minus is a good risk cytogenetic. This is like kind of what I remember. So that gives me a score of 0. And when they looked at the number of blasts in my bone marrow, they said, you had 4% blasts. So that also gives me a 0. So when you add up all my categories, 0, 0, 0, I come up with a grand score of 0, which puts me in a low risk category of MDS. Okay? So that's how you score it. Now, a high risk MDS patient, so say, you know, I come in and I get the diagnosis and I have all of my cells are low. I'm neutropenic, I'm anemic, I'm thrombocytopenic. So all three cell lines are down. And my cytogenetics are what we consider a complex karyotype. It looks like alphabet soup if you're reading about my DNA. And they tell me I have 10% blast in my bone marrow. So how does that score? And what does that mean? So for the low-risk person who has a score of 0, remember, without treatment, we know that those people have an average life expectancy from 5 to 7 years, 4 to 7 years, okay? Now I'm a high-risk person, right? Because you add up all my cytopenias, my cytogenetics, and the number of blasts, and you give me a score that now is greater than 2.5 when you add those up, I'm considered a high-risk person. My life expectancy without any treatment is less than a year. That's how you make out. That's what it means to score yourself with the IPSS scoring system. And what that does for the clinician is it gives them insight into the tempo of your disease, you know, kind of what's going on, what can be expected, and insight into what's an appropriate therapy for you. Because if I'm a 0, you're going to treat me one way. And if I'm a high risk, you're going to treat me totally differently. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So in the book, and even if you just Google, see, I'm assuming that people like to go on the internet, but if you Google IPSS, there's a lot of web pages that you can plug your stuff in. Remember, you don't rescore yourself. You do it from your initial workup. That's where that information comes from.
Why don't they rescore? What if you get better on your own?
So the data looked at, because when you analyze how was the data done, so the original IPSS score looked at when people were diagnosed. What did they use?
That could change, right?
What could change?
This doesn't apply.
So why is it scored that way? When the original data was done about the IPSS scoring system, what the reason it was done was back in the, you know, in the 90s, so that paper came out and was published in 97. Why it was done was people didn't have a good understanding of what MDS was, and they tried to identify what were the characteristics of patients that said this is the characteristic of the disease, and this is what we know about it. Is it age? Is it gender? Was it thyroid? What, you know, they looked at a myriad of, and those were the three things that really helped prognosticate what was going to happen with the disease and identify it. So they are looking retrospective in the data. So they had 900 different patients that had those workups, and so they teased out from all those patients what their score was, and they looked over time how people did, because at that point in time there were no approved treatments, what the longevity was and what was the survival. And so that's where those numbers came from.
Because he was diagnosed with a 5 when he was originally.
So Sylvia's saying that Richard was a 5. Now remember, one of the, and what you hear about is that people, you know, that you have to understand the context of the IPSS scoring system. It prognosticates survival without treatment. Mm-hmm. Okay? And that's a drawback, because as people get treated and we have good therapies, it changes the outcome, right? Because, I mean, even for a low-risk person, like Mr. Hensel, I get to pick on him. So, you know, he's 11 years on this drug, and there is no 11 years on even for a low-risk person. But, you know, we have to change with the available therapies, because now we have therapies that really do help change that. And then someone truly with a 5, I mean, you can get a number of cycles. Your blood counts get normal, right? So then you're thinking about how many cytopenias I have. So the tool is not designed to be workable with your changing blood counts and with your changing disease status. It's just a tool.
You might start as a 5, but you won't stay a 5.
That's absolutely true. You know, and the goal is that, you know, you may be a 5, and yes, you need treatment, but you're not going to quote-unquote stay a 5. It's one of the shortcomings of the tool. That's all it is. It's a tool.
The drugs that you're talking about, are those a low intensity chemotherapy? Is that what those are? Or?
So Revlimid is an oral medicine, right? And it's indicated for people who have 5Q minus. So, and 5Q minus folks tend to have a lower risk score, right? Because when we scored, when I pretended to be a 5Q minus patient, I had a very low score. And in general, that's how people present. They're anemic. I don't know how you presented, but you can't fit that picture.
5Q minus.
Now, these other drugs that people have talked about, azacitidine or Vidaza, right, or D-cytidine or Dacogen, those are, they both fit under the category of being hypomethylators. That's how they work. They work like they demethylate things. And those are really used for people who have intermediate to high-risk disease.
Is that, what I'm trying to understand, though, is that a low-dose chemotherapy? Is that what that is? Is that what those are?
They're both considered chemotherapy.
Okay. And is there, if you're on it for a long time, can it build a toxicity in your system over time?
What do you think, Richard? You've been on it 6 years. Do you get kind of toxic being on the drug, or?
No.
Pass the microphone,
never.
Sylvia. No. He's
no.
Saying no. How about somebody else? Who else in here in this room has had been treated with a hypomethylator? Anybody else? What do you think?
21 months.
21 months on?
Azacitidine
or Vidaza. Shot or infusion?
Infusion port.
Through the port. So it's a drug that can be given as a shot, or it can be given. A lot of people have portacast, so which they can use for lots of different things, and so they get it as an infused drug.
When you have it that often, a port is really the way to go.
Yeah,
because
the shot,
your veins
kind of, you know, they get fatigued.
So, I mean, but what I'm asking is, can you be on it for years and it doesn't build toxicity? Or
correct. Yeah,
average life cycle is 18 months. There are the exceptions that I'm sitting next to.
Yeah.
There's others right across from me
I quit working at 13 months.
So the average cycle is 18 months.
The average
and then you go,
life expectancy,
and then you would go off
or?
It?
Average life cycle of the effectiveness of the drug.
So some people, you know, and I will tell you, I mean, these group of drugs work for some people. Sometimes they don't. And there's no way to predict who's going to do really well and who's not going to do well. But there are therapies that are relatively easy to tolerate. You know, they don't make you lose your hair. Sorry. that he came with that. you know, they don't cause a lot of, I don't, you chime in. I would say in my experience, some people have some nausea, other people really don't. Some people have a little bit of GI complaint like dyspepsia, constipation, diarrhea. You know, there's a mixed bag, right? But people generally do pretty well with the therapies compared to paralleling someone who's getting acute leukemia treatment, which causes your blood counts to drop really low, and, you know, they have higher intensity therapies. They have side effects. Absolutely, they have side effects. How well you deal with them, I think, some of it is mindset. And some of it is just how do you do that? You know,
your body chemistry too. I think now he's diabetic also. He has a pump that he
so you have an insulin
every 3 days.
Okay.
So you know, I don't think there's an answer. I mean, it's just what doesn't work for him, you know, may work for somebody else, vice
right.
versa. I mean,
just, and we've had. So go back to your question again. Ask your question since now I can't remember it.
Well, no, I'm just wondering about. You know, how long can you be on it?
How long
and
can
then,
you?
And then if as you do have to go off it, what happens to you? If your levels are good, does it mean you'll drop? Or are you in remission?
So it sounds like that's what happens. It really depends. As you work with your oncologist about what your plan is, you know, if you're an intermediate or a high-risk patient, okay, it's not unreasonable to start with a hypomethylator, okay, with Vidaza or with decitabine. That's relatively common. And because of what we know, how these drugs work, we know it's going to take 4 to 6 cycles. That means 4 to 6 months of treatment before we can tell if they're really, really working for you. And remember we talked about, like, things will get worse before they get better because, and one of the reasons is, when you have a diseased bone marrow with MDS, as you get rid of the malignancy and the bad cells go away, sometimes the bone marrow itself is recalibrating to work up to its full potential. Because sometimes those malignant cells actually do benefit your blood counts, and when you begin to take them away, then the blood counts drop. And then as the normal, healthy bone marrow continues to regenerate, then your blood counts can get better.
See, and that's one thing I didn't realize, because I noticed, you know, after he had been on Vidaza, I said, gee, his counts are dropping. And he said, that's normal.
That's normal. And that's normal, totally expected.
Yeah.
Totally, totally expected. Now, the second part of your question, how long can you do it? It depends what the plan of care is. Now, I don't know how old you are, Richard, but...
He's 81.
You're 81. Okay, so, you know, we don't transplant people who are 81 years old because stem cell therapy, to undergo a stem cell transplant is exceptionally rigorous on your body systems. And so there's been a line in the sand that's been drawn that says 70, early 70s, 71, 72 years old is kind of the extent of people's comfort level of when they will do an allogeneic stem cell transplant because it's a difficult therapy. So knowing that that's not an option for Richard, it makes sense to me that he continues on other therapies. But, you know, it does get to a point in time, 5 years you've been on it, it's like, hey, let's space it out and see what happens.
And that's what you did.
And your blood count started to slide. So somehow that malignant clone began to regrow and repopulate and come back. And sometimes it can be sensitive again to the hypomethylator. Sometimes it doesn't. I had a patient who, he was a professor, and he developed actually a therapy-related MDS. He was a gentleman who had prostate cancer, and when men have prostate cancer, they get their pelvises radiated. So this is the pelvic field, and as adults, this is where a lot of our hematopoiesis takes place, in the pelvis. So they call it the pelvic field. Mm-hmm. And so he had external damage from radiation to his bone marrow stroma, and he developed a therapy-related MDS. And he went on therapy with azacitidine, Vidaza, and he did it, and he had a great response, and he became transfusion independent, and he said, I'm done, I'm going to Arizona. So he went to Arizona, And he said, I'll see you in February. We are like, okay, we gave him all kind of instructions, whatever. He came back, and his blood counts were okay, and then they started to drift slowly. And in the summer, he said, okay, I'm ready to do this again. And so we did this cycle with him where he would get treated. He'd say, I'm now going to Europe. I've always wanted to go to Europe. I'm going to Europe. So he'd go to Europe, and then he came back, and then we would reset. And we did that a couple of times. But there did come a time where he didn't respond. For whatever reason, I mean, the biology of these diseases is very sophisticated, and we just don't know enough. I mean, we're learning more and more, but, you know, for this gentleman, his quality of life and what he wanted to do to live life was to bucket list going to Europe or, you know, doing whatever, and he was able to do that and said, I'm willing to take the risk that this might not work again. So... But now if you're a younger person and your doctor's looking at a stem cell transplant, they may give you a number of cycles, and then in the process of you getting treated, maybe begin to look for a donor, asking siblings to come in and be typed, etc. So it really depends, you know, that individualized therapy.
But how would you know at what point you're at that you would need, that you would consider that transplant?
A transplant? So if you're under the age of 72, your doctor has already looked at you saying transplant is the cure. That's the lens that you get looked at from an oncology perspective, honestly. Because one of the first things that gets asked are, do you have brothers and sisters, right? Because why? Because they're looking for a genetic match. Question.
Haven't they recently dropped the age for transplants?
What do you mean drop the age? Like, well, made it lower?
Yes. To 65. And even less than that.
So there are some transplant centers around the country who will only transplant people until a certain age. The transplant center that I work at, we're transplanting people. Our oldest has been 72.
Okay.
We've done a good handful of people who have been in their early 70s. Now, they're robust 70-year-olds. They're not somebody who's that performance status of being in bed all the time. That's not them. They're really active kind of folks. But if you go to the Fred Hutch Center in Seattle, which is like the largest transplant center, if you're over 55, I think they turn you away. So there are some criteria, you know, better outcomes. It really depends. And the biggest gatekeeper of all within that process is your insurance company. You know, written into the very fine print of all of our insurance policies is, if you need a stem cell transplant, which none of us ever bothered to read, you will go to A, B, or C institution. So, go ahead.
Or do they look at, they say, well, this person is 75, his life expectancy is fairly narrow. Let's give it to a person who's got more life expectancy.
No. Nope.
Because that happened in, who was that baseball player?
That was a liver transplant.
Yeah, well.
That's
yeah.
Different. We don't talk about that.
But still, no.
But that organ had to be secured from a donor, right? You get your bone, you can get stem cells from your siblings. Now, right. If you're 70, there's a good chance that your siblings are 70 plus, right? And to mobilize, to get their stem cells and to collect them is more of a medical challenge just because of the biology of aging with their normal stem cells. So it can be, but we've had patients in their 70s donate to their siblings in their 50s and they mobilize. And there's a couple new medicines out there too that help succeed. You know, we have better success with that. But age somewhat is, it's limiting, it's just the way it is. I will tell you that the mortality risk with a stem cell transplant, even if you're 50, for the first 30 days is still 20%, period, just across the board. It's just, you know, things can happen unexpectedly with transplant. People get bad infections, etc. So, I mean, it is part of the thinking process with transplant because it's appropriate. But for some people, it's not appropriate. If you're 82, it's not appropriate. It just isn't. But it's not just it. So there is an age piece, but you just got to look around and see. Question.
Sure.
So what's the criteria to choose a donor? Okay, so I'm the patient again, all right? Now, I have a mother and I had a father. And so genetically, if you remember back to biology, then you get half of your genetic material from your mother and you get half of it from your father. So my brothers and sisters also had the same opportunity to get from mother and father. And just because of how gene shuffling occurs, you literally have a 1 in 4 chance of identically matching your sibling. So the first piece that's done for me, the patient, is to get my biologically related siblings, full siblings, okay? Same mom and same dad, to get them typed, okay? Now, if they're, say I don't have any matches, okay, what's the next step? The next step is to go to something called the National Marrow Donor Bank. And this is all done via numbers. So when I am typed, they draw a couple vials of blood and they do an HLA typing on one of my chromosomes, the 6th chromosome. And that becomes a whole series in grouping of numbers. And we have that set aside. So now it's matching, okay? Does anybody match? And it has everything to do with ethnic origin, okay? So if you're half Portuguese and half Eastern European, finding a match for you is probably going to be pretty different because there's really not a lot of people who are Portuguese and Eastern European descent that are going to share that genetic material. You may be really lucky. Minority groups have a more difficult time, but it is an international search, and so it all depends. So that's the next step. Now, you know, sometimes you get a match and sometimes you don't. Now, if you don't get a match, the other option that's more, it is investigational, something called a half match or a haplomatch. So if my brothers and sisters don't match me 100%, they're for sure going to match me half, right? Because we have the same parents, wink, wink, right? And so hopefully they're going to be half a match, unless my mom was just being kind of rogue. So you can do a haplo and then a cord. And there are a lot of people nowadays, after they deliver their babies, they donate the umbilical cord blood at the delivery, and that's automatically taken, frozen, and put in a bank. And that's pretty easy. There are companies that's what they do for a living. Okay, they secure these cords and it's frozen. And you go ahead and you look for a haplo cord. So that's another option if you can't secure a donor.
Those are stem cell rich.
Those are very stem cell rich. So those little babies, you know, that little cord is very dense. Now, the only potential problem is if you're a person who's, you know, 120 pounds, that's good. If you're somebody who's 420 pounds, that little cord and all those stem cells, I mean, you do need a certain percentage to repopulate your bone marrow. So it gets a little tricky. You know, size matters.
Do they ever look at relatives?
Like, so let's go back to biology. Here's my mom and here's my dad. Here's my cousin. How much genetic material do I share with my cousin? Well, my cousin's mother is my father's sister. So the genetic likelihood of you matching with a relative statistically is less than if we look in the International Donor Marrow Registry.
How about children?
Children. So children, good. Mom and dad, and now I have children. My DNA and my husband's. How much DNA am I giving to my kids?
Yeah.
Half. What's the greatest likelihood? How much am I going to match with my children? Half. So a haplo. There are these uber rare people who do match with their kids, but it's infinitely rare. Infinitely rare. So we do that. I mean, my institution happens to do something called these haplocords. They are investigational. We've had good results, but it's not the standard of care. So you can look for children, but only after those other pieces are done. Look at my siblings, look at the National Marrow Donor Registry, and then you look at children. Question.
Why do I get constipated every time I get chemo?
Do you take a drug called ondansetron?
Yep.
Zofran?
Ondansetron.
There's your answer. He asked how come he can't go to the little boy's room? Because ondansetron's biggest side effect is constipation. It slows the motility. So I would say if you're taking an ondansetron, take a Senecot S or a pericolase, softener and mild laxative.
Well, we have this. It's like a...
Yeah.
can't think of what it's called.
Is it tea? Is it called Smooth Moo? There's some people, no. Have you heard about that?
No, this is actually from
Miralax.
Miralax is now over the counter?
It's a tea. You can trick
my brain. No, the stuff that she gave you.
So I would think, Richard, that's why. The Vidaza doesn't make you constipated, but the Zofran does, or the Ondansetron does.
A
question.
It took me 5 months with my incontinence team, both in Wisconsin and Chicago, to figure out the formula so that, number one, I dropped my Zofran down to 4 milligrams, but then I start drinking Smooth Move tea.
He drinks the Smooth Move tea. You guys think I was making this stuff up. It's true.
And then day number three, I augment that with one. So I go to, next Wednesday, I start drinking day 1, 2, 3, the tea alone, and then I go to bed and drink the tea with 1 Cinnacott S. And
you guys think I make this stuff up.
I guess what I'm trying to say is everybody's different. And what you have to do is push your oncologist team and the pharmacist and everyone you can talk to, because the Zofran can really make it very uncomfortable.
It can make it just miserable. Where do you buy Smooth Move tea? We all want to know.
You can buy it at any grocery store in the organic area.
All right. Did you get that? Buy Smooth Move.
For me.
It's rich in Seneca. It's a mild laxative. It really.
But it's a combination.
Yeah.
First 3 days.
Exactly.
And then tea and
Seneca. So he's figured out his magic recipe. You have to figure out your own. But there are some other options out there. Miralax. Sandy's got a question.
Regarding stem cells.
Stem cells. Okay. It's a hot topic today, you guys.
When I was first diagnosed, which was 3 years ago, and I asked my...
We're going to ask you to use the microphone because they can't hear you back there, right?
I asked my oncologist at that time, well, what about a stem cell transplant?
Right.
After I read up about the whole thing, I had no clue. And it was, don't even think about that. And my reasoning was, I'm younger.
Mm-hmm.
I'm healthy, relatively healthy, except for this one blood cell count that was low. Why would you not... do that?
I can't speak for your oncologist. I can say that getting a second opinion is often really good medicine. Mm-hmm. This is a rare disorder, and there are a lot of people who don't see a lot of MDS. Rush, Dr. Shimano sees a lot of patients. We see a lot of patients, but, you could be someplace where your physician doesn't see a lot. And I think there's great validity to getting a second opinion. I did.
And? I did do that, but I didn't even get the opportunity to ask that question because it's like, oh no, I was intermediate.
Intermediate risk.
And it was like, don't even think about it.
Yeah.
Anybody else? They really push it off.
They pushed it off. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else want to speak to that comment, talking to a second opinion, getting a second opinion that kind of you're uncomfortable with? Doctors are your employees.
I think they don't want to put you in harm's way too soon if you can survive without any symptoms.
Right.
I mean, the problem is, that's where I'm at.
Yeah.
I have no symptoms.
Okay.
I work all day. I go to the barn and ride my horse every day. Mm-hmm. I don't feel sick.
Right.
They're telling me I'm sick.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not buying
who else
it
can put? Who wants to raise their
fun.
Hand and put their stamp on that? Who else was in that group when they got diagnosed? Feeling good, blood count's great.
When I first was diagnosed.
When you're first diagnosed.
When you're first diagnosed.
My blood count isn't great.
And your blood count's
my red and my white are low.
Your red and your white are kind of low, and you've had
no, they're blast. Low.
100% blast.
Yeah, and I have 11% blast.
Okay.
But I'm not sick.
You feel well. Feel well. You have a bone marrow.
And I got no infections or anything. My whole family, my kids, my husband all had flu and colds. And I work with children. I teach.
That's good.
So but what's going on? I mean, they tell me I'm sick.
Right.
I'm...
Well, you have a disease it's not going to go away, and you need to be monitored. We talked about triggers for treatment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you transfusion dependent? Your answer is no. Are you getting more infections? The answer is no. I don't know what your blast count is going. You know, I mean, there's, unfortunately, you only check it with a bio, you know, you only check it with the exam. And, you know, and if you're continuing to feel well, I don't know what your cytogenetics are.
None.
You have no cytogenetic abnormalities.
Right.
So, I mean, that intermediary group is, for clinicians, it's kind of like this fuzzy group. People are doing well. They have a great quality of life. Things don't really seem to be mattering. You know, I mean, there's really nothing to do, except I would encourage you to remain vigilant.
Yeah.
You know, if they're asking you to come in once a month for a blood count, I would definitely do that regardless of how you felt.
I go every 3 months.
Every 3 months, yeah. And have you had a second opinion?
Yeah, I just went and had one. She was pushing the clinical trial. I said, no, clinical trial. And then she started talking about a transplant. So...
yeah.
Now she's talking about, you know, me going in. The insurance company has approved me to have the testing done.
For the transplant?
Mm-hmm. And they typed me. Mm-hmm. So they haven't got the results back yet.
Mm-hmm. It takes about 3 weeks.
So, I mean, I feel like I could do it.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely do. But as I read about it, I realize that you're not officially cured. I mean, it can come back.
That's true.
And there is a rate. It can come back as a secondary cancer, too.
Right.
Like you might end up with a different cancer. So it seems like it's not the total answer either.
It's not a simple illness. You know, I mean, there are lots of variabilities, you know, within everyone's illness.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's when I asked the doctor originally about a stem cell transplant like you.
Mm-hmm.
And basically he said, well, why would we do that to you right now? You're having no symptoms. You're not, you know, why would we do that? I could kill you.
This
you know,
is
that's
true.
Basically right. what he said.
This
I
is
could
true.
Kill you yeah. with the procedure.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, you don't just jump into therapy for a transplant. The first piece is to really get your MDS under control. 11% blasts. So, you know, 11% blasts. You should have 5 or less, right? In the classification systems, you know, when we even look at what's the difference between MDS and AML? So, you know, there was the old classification, that was the FAB, right, and the WHO. So in the FAB classification, if you have 30% blasts, you have acute leukemia. In the WHO, it's 20.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that really is, it doesn't sound like a big difference, but it is a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I would...
There's a lot of old thinking and new thinking going on.
Well, there's just revision. It's kind of like, you know, if you have 20%, you know, in probably a short amount of time, you're going to have 30%. And, you know, what's been found through the years is that when people have an intermediate or a high-risk disease, they do need to be treated because the disease continues to progress. You know, so I would say just, you know, keep following it. And, you know, it'd be interesting, you know, you need to find a practitioner that you trust. When that person says to you, I recommend you go this way, you say, I'm on board. You know, you could go to this guy over here and you go, I don't really like that, you know. Mm-hmm. And you get this uncomfortable feeling. You know, I think you really do need to look for someone that you feel exceptionally confident with. You know, you're putting your hands in this practitioner's life. You know, you're really asking, it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't found that somebody, then, you know, feel free to ask the people in the room, you know, do you like your doctor? Is he great, you know, great guy, great gal? Do they know what they're talking about? It's a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big, big deal. You have to find the right person. And I'm kind of hearing that you haven't really found that person. So, other questions? 25 after. Question?
You were talking about the umbilical cord. How do
yes.
you go about doing that?
So if you're pregnant...
I have a daughter who's pregnant.
You contact the International Bone Marrow Registry, and you work through them. So you can even Google umbilical cord donations, and it has to be set up and organized before the delivery, usually a bit of time beforehand, like a good 4 to 6 weeks beforehand
okay.
to donate.
Or OBGYN might have information, too.
There you go. Be
kind.
Okay. I'm going to ask her about that. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're going to deliver, they would have it as well.
Yeah.
They even have kits that can get in the delivery room.
Oh, really? Okay.
There's a fee, and oftentimes there's a fee for the donor, which seems ridiculous.
Yeah, right.
But I, there was that difference between a public donation and a private donation, and so there's some...
She going to do that?
Question again.
She's the one she's in.
My mom is not living here. She's not a U.S. citizen.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So in the case that we are looking for more another opinion,
right?
Is there any possibility to do that here in the United States without insurance because she has insurance?
Right. Well, I would suggest two things. So your comment is your mom lives in Venezuela, right? Just so for people who can't hear you, which I think most people aren't able to hear what you're saying. So your mom's from Venezuela, and you're looking for a second opinion. You know, could she do something in the United States? You can. It's a fee for service. You know, and if you want to get a second opinion of someone here, you can. I mean, I would honestly, in the back of the MDS Foundation, there are centers of excellence, and that means, you know, these centers see a lot of people with MDS. Yes. And, you know, you do need to see somebody who is experienced with a disorder. I would say look through there and match up where you live and make a phone call and say, you know, we want to come for a second opinion. And you just say, it's a fee for service. It's an out-of-pocket expense that, you know, your mom has no insurance. You can do that.
Yeah, but my question is more, I mean, in the case that she has to receive a
treatment.
Treatment.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And in my country, it's not possible because she already has the test with her sister.
Okay.
So they're compatible.
Uh-huh.
But they are not compatible. 100%.
Right.
And she barely has.
Right, right. So I'm really not super, I'm not familiar with health systems outside of the United States. I do know that in the back of this booklet, it does give you some international references to look for. But again, if people aren't a match, the type of service that you can get from any one transplant center is limited by what they offer. You know, if they put the age limit at 60 and say, if you're over 60 and you don't have a sibling donor, we don't do the transplants, then that's the situation. You know, like you were saying, it's not a therapy that's benign. It's a rigorous therapy with quite a few side effects, and you need to be robust enough, and the center has to be expert enough to be able to handle the difficulties that are going to arise, and they're going to arise, you know? So I would look in the back of this book or go online and get some recommendations. But it's a bit of consumer shopping of where can you go and get the service that she needs. Other questions?
Can you explain, my blasts are under 5%.
Okay.
And yet my blood counts started with just low platelets. And I had low white count. Now I have low red count. Now all three are low. Why does that keep going down?
So Sandy's comment is her blasts are low in her bone marrow, but her blood counts are starting to drift. Have you had treatment?
Well, I was on the clinical trial.
You were on a clinical trial of?
It was the combo. It was Dr. Shimol's trial with the combo drugs of Vidaza and Revlimid.
Okay.
Which I flunked because they kept
the drugs failed
down.
You.
They my count kept going
low. Lower and lower.
They couldn't keep doing it.
Okay.
So she just had to stop.
So she stopped.
Right.
And are you on a bit of a holiday?
And since I stopped it, which was in February, my hemoglobin was like in the 11s.
Mm-hmm.
And lowest was like 10.5, and now 9.3.
So Sandy's question is, you know, she was on these treatments and her blood counts got low. Please take some of the stuff in the back as you guys leave. I would think that initially she removed you from the therapy because your blood counts were decreasing.
Right.
And I would think that she hoped that by removing the therapies you'd have some recovery.
Right.
Yeah. And has she done another bone marrow biopsy?
Oh, I've had five.
You've had five of them. Yeah.
And the blasts are not increasing.
Right.
That's why I don't. It's like, why is the disease progressing
right.
if the blasts?
Because the blasts are only one
element.
One element of the disorder. Okay. You know, the whole bone marrow matrix. And there's lots of other things that you don't see when you see a slide of this. There are all these cytokines and molecular markers and downstream. You know, there's lots of other biology happening in your bone marrow other than just your blast. So,
okay.
You know, if she's telling you that your disease is continuing to...
No, but she was really happy that my blasts weren't.
Well, yeah,
she
that's
was,
a good
she was
thing.
More like,
yeah, that's good, but you know. for whatever reason, yeah. Your bone marrow's not coming back.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say. Sometimes people who get these therapies have prolonged cytopenia, so when they talk about adjusting therapies, like pulling back and seeing if people can recover is a common strategy.
Okay.
Not always effective because, you know, maybe it's not the drugs that are doing it. Maybe it's something else that, you know, your disease has decided that these drugs are no longer going to be effective.
Okay. Which is like, that's the other option, is to do nothing with this disease.
Well, it is an option.
I mean,
it's always an option.
Sometimes
you have to wait and watch, you
yeah.
know. You
yeah.
have to see what's going to happen. Yeah. Other questions?
It's education is what it is.
Continuing education.
It's
you got
hard,
it.
It's a hard thing to deal with, though, because...
It is a hard thing.
Once you know you have it, it kind of... It's ruined my life for the last year because I know
that
it's there.
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right.
And it's very annoying. Like, I mean, it keeps me from sleeping at night sometimes because it's on my mind and I can't let it go. You know, the doctor will be like, well, you need to just let it go. How can you? Once
right.
I would rather not know. I would have had a good year.
How about some of the other survivors in this room? How do you deal with that?
One day at a time.
How do you sleep? How do you deal with the anxiety? What do you do?
Like the doctor told me, the first diagnosis, don't worry about it. One day at a time, there's nothing you can do. He says, try to make
good enough for me.
Just do it one day at a time. And if you do what you want to do one day at a time, you'll worry about it, but you won't be consumed. You
get too smart.
Getting too smart. Richard, how about you? What do you think? What kind of advice would you give?
You live with it.
Live with it.
Yeah. Live today.
Live today.
Tomorrow.
Just live today.
Words from the back row?
I think you just learn to deal with it and get up every morning and do what you feel like doing.
Okay.
Like so.
Stay positive. Stay positive. How do you stay positive when, like, you're fretting and, you know, worry, and then you read the stuff on the internet and you go, ooh? How do you stay positive?
Go to a hospital and volunteer and see people.
Do something outside yourself.
See somebody who's really, really in trouble.
There's always
exercise?
Somebody that's worse off than you are.
Your mother told you that, didn't she?
She did.
She
so.
Did.
Go to Cranes in Michigan
and
have lunch.
Go to Michigan and eat.
Go to the casino.
Go to the casino. Yeah. But it's, I mean, coping with a chronic illness is difficult. And somehow, you know, we're all unique people. We've got very different backgrounds and family situations. And, you know, going to a counselor is a good idea. You know, maybe you need, you know, you might be able to benefit from someone external saying, you know, giving you some input to help you retool your perspective.
Yeah. One thing we thought of is, nobody's promised tomorrow.
No one's promised tomorrow.
Right. And, I mean, both of us. We could be killed in a car accident today or, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
And you know, nobody knows what their time frame is here on Earth.
Yeah. It's very difficult. It's very difficult. You had a comment in the back.
Oh, okay. You were asking when I get regular massages, I do yoga, I mean all those other things. I do energy healing.
Well, yeah, I mean I don't sit around the house, you know, fretting. I mean I go to work every day, I do all the things I normally do, but it's never, I can't get away from it no matter what I do. It's always there. It's always biting at me. You know, I feel like I'm always trying to run away from it. That's annoying.
We have some input from the front.
I think the one thing that was not said, put your faith in God. The power of prayer works. God has a plan for every one of us here. And as long as you put your faith in the Lord, He will help you. And you've all lived a good long life, I'll be honest with you. And hopefully we'll live a lot longer. Think of the people that 10 years old or 20 years old. So be thankful for what you have. Be positive and say a prayer. That's the biggest remedy.
Right. Well, you know, and it sounds like, you know, you're doing all the right things. You know, you're looking for different opinions. You know, you've sought out different opinions, and, you know, you need to take care of yourself and, you know, do things to make yourself feel better and in staying positive. And
how long ago were you diagnosed?
Like May of last year.
See, it takes a while, I think. I think it takes quite a while to get over that hump. Yeah, you accept that you have the disease, and then you just kind of
move forward
from there. Mm-hmm. But it takes longer than a year, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Nobody
said life was easy.
It's nice, too, knowing that there are other people that are dealing with this. I've never, ever heard of another person having MDS until we came to the first symposium. And I was shocked at how many people were there.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, gives you a little bit of hope, too, mm-hmm. that there are other people dealing with the same thing.
Another comment from the back.
Try not to let this be an interruption in your life.
Try not to let it don't.
Normally,
try.
Get up in the morning and read the paper.
I don't know, you're doing it. You're still doing all your own stuff.
You're a runner, or maybe you're a tennis player, or you're a sewer.
Not true.
That should be your goal for you.
You can't do it.
Yeah.
To get up and do the thing that gives you pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
This is it is an interruption in your life in many cases. Don't let it be.
Yeah. Other questions?
You try to do that. However, I had to give up tennis. I had to, you know. So there are also limitations, which is what you have to accept and deal with also.
Who funds clinical trials? So there are different types of clinical trials. There can be investigator initiative. So say, once again, I'm using myself as an example, but say I'm a doctor and I say, I know that substance A and substance B work together. There's a whole process of getting that through. So a lot of times those are quote unquote unsupported. It's just the physician saying, let's try to mix this drug and that drug. If there's a new drug under development, you're getting the drug from the company. You know, and oftentimes, the companies who are like involved in drug development, they know who the movers and shakers are, say in MDS, and so they'll go to those physicians and say, like the Onconova trial, you know, you have MDS patients, would you be willing? And it's very rigorous. So some of it is private funding, some of it is government funding. You know, the National Cancer Institute.
Insurance doesn't cover it, so the individual's responsible for that.
No, if you enroll in a clinical trial, insurance companies cannot not allow you to participate in it. And most of the times, if it's a drug, then the drug is provided free. Like when you first went on the clinical trial, the drug wasn't available, correct? And he received drug free of charge for...
He still does.
So that
only the drug. All the other follow-up stuff is out of your pocket.
No. When I was in the clinical trial, everything was covered.
It
cost me nothing.
I think it depends.
It really depends.
The drug company pays for most of it.
Yeah, it depends on how the protocol is written and what's allowed at the various institutions. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it could be that the drug alone is covered, and sometimes drug companies will say, you know, whatever patients enroll on the trial, we'll continue to provide them drug until they start pushing up the daisies. You know, they give drug forever, which it's great. There are other studies that say we'll provide until if the drug gets approved, then the person will just have to get it, you know, through regular means. Sometimes blood, like if there are additional blood tests that are needed, if there are bone marrows that are needed, those will be covered because they're not considered a normal follow-up of a hematological problem. So there's really...
His insurance company covered those with the drug we got for free, but that was...
The only thing that was free was the drug itself.
Right.
Everything else was a fee.
Right, and it was considered standard of care. Like right, and so the insurance company would say you were seeing the physician, and you know you had CBCs or you had a blood transfusion. You know that gets covered. However, the insurance that you have, but then there are other clinical trials that have these huge umbrellas and. There's just so much variability. Mm-hmm. And we have all of those trials where I work. We have investigator-led that are, you know, it's just we have the drug, but everything else is standard of care. And then we've got, you know, examples like yours that say it covers everything. So, but usually things that are considered standard of care don't get covered, like the visit or the CBC. It just, there's so much variability. Yeah. Question?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Can a
non-U.S. citizen be part? So when clinical trials are written, they're very explicit on who's allowed and who's not. And many, 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 if not all the time, if it's being hosted in the United States, they exclude people because they want to be able to continue to follow people. And so they'll say, like, you know, like you can't have HIV, you can't be pregnant, you know, has to be 18 and older, U.S., they will put that restriction. Sometimes. Not all the time, but sometimes. Every protocol is different. But that can happen.
What do you see in the future with Obamacare coming into it?
What do I see? You really want to know that?
With all this...
Bible's closed.
All these problems that...
Yeah.
I mean, you know, is our level of care going to go down?
It's hard to say.
The medications, you know.
I mean, funding has already been cut for lots of, there's been funding cuts across the board to the National Cancer Institute, and, you know, they really fund investigators and drug development. I mean, the government does do a lot of drug development through the NCI and through various other mechanisms.
Well, the sequestration has resulted in cuts across
the board. Right, across. The sequestration has just kind of, like, lopped
it
off.
That's not the president. Yeah. It's Congress.
But there are, you know, entrepreneurial people who fund private funds and will still invest in pharmaceutical companies. So I think that will continue. It's just going to look different. I mean, over the 3 decades that I've been in practice, it's looked different every 10 years. So I think it will continue. It's just going to look different. And I would hope that it will be very interesting to see. I mean, if you take a look at socialized medicine, you know, there are many countries in the world that practice socialized medicine, and they say if you have disease X, you get treatment Y.
Right,
you know,
period.
In Europe, in Italy, for example, the government says if you have MDS, you can have EPO therapy or injections. You can have a transplant, but we don't cover azacitidine. However, if my private employer or if I have money, I can still get it. So there will, I think, continue to be that type of subset. England is a pretty good example of restricted health care, as well as the Netherlands. So how it gets implemented in our country is, as it rolls out, we'll all find out.
It's not socialization.
We just don't know. So, anything else? One more.
I've experienced certain symptoms since being diagnosed. For instance, I've lost weight and I have not been able to regain it. And even though I eat 3 meals a day.
That's interesting.
I also have swollen ankles periodically. Mm. I'm just wondering if other people have other symptoms like that or something.
Other symptoms for folks? Weight loss?
When I first found out, I lost 10 pounds.
You lost 10 pounds?
Yeah.
All right.
First found out.
When you first found out?
And I'm back up.
You're back. Yeah. It's unusual for people with MDS to have that. I don't know what's going on concurrently. Usually weight loss is not something, but...
Further proof that I no longer have MDS. I continue to get heavier.
I don't have a good answer for you. Other than it's unusual, you know. Do you see a good doctor? Check your thyroid.
You ever drink Ensure? Milkshake, and sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
That's the second time we've talked about thyroid. What is thyroid?
Your thyroid can, you know, it affects your bone marrow function.
Uh-huh.
So if you're severely hypothyroid, you can be anemic. That's why. And it's very common. So common things occur commonly, so you kind of look for the... what could be a possible easy fix?
The only reason why you even say that is what I hate to bring back, but part of the reason they claim that I got MDS is their radiation treatments
to
my forehead.
Your forehead?
Because that was a, even I had on 60 Minutes, how I got on it, it all radiation accumulates in your thyroid.
It has an effect on it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and years ago, this is before my time, they used to treat, they would radiate people's thyroids, and they also used to radiate people's adenoids when they had repeated infections. So, I mean, things that were done a long time ago seem to make sense, and it was the current state of medicine, but now here we are decades later, and the repercussions are unpredictable.
Like the doctor told me when I was talking to him about it back in the 70s. You know, he said that, well, half the people that actually worked on radiation died from it anyway.
Yeah, yeah. The guy who actually invented, his name was Rogan, and he used to repeatedly do his hand, and the guy ended up with, like, some type of osteosarcoma of the bone of the hand that he x-rayed a kabillion times, so...
So how did he avoid radiation?
An X-ray, a chest X-ray has an equivalent amount of radiation as a half a day of sunshine.
Yeah.
So it's minimal.
It's the CTs you want.
You want CAT scans, yes, but this isn't a disease that gets repetitive CAT scans like our lymphoma folks.
Right.
So, all right, time to go. Thank you. Thanks for coming. Grab your food at the back, okay?
All right.